Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Bonjour, and thank you for listening to the Footswise podcast. I'm coming at you live from the gods. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And currently reciting Shakespeare on a unicycle is Flixwise co-producer and esteemed host of Flixwise Canada, Mr. Martin Kessler. Hi, Martin.
Quiet, I can't hear the pantomime.
It's good times. It's been too long, Martin.
It's been a bit. It's been a whole intermission's worth of time.
It's true. Oh, dear. It's been a whole, Children of Paradise's worth of time. And currently running through throngs of creepy dudes in creepy clown costumes. Oh, I'm sorry, Perot costumes is Miss Becky Deanna. Welcome to Flixwise, Becky.
Oh, thank you. It's exciting to be on here.
If I'm not mistaken, this is Becky's debut appearance on Flixwise Mothership.
Yes.
Which, that seems hard to believe, given how frequently we've chatted over the internet. But I suppose good things come to those who wait.
Yeah, best for last. Yeah.
Exactly, yes. I mean, we're just taking this whole thing to a whole new level. I'm excited.
Yeah. Plus, you're a fellow Angeleno, correct?
It's true, although I recently moved to Wisconsin. But I'm always be an Angeleno at heart.
Nice.
Yeah. And Becky picked quite a doozy to start with. Today's sight and sound entry is the 3+ hour poetic realist epic, L'Enfant du Paradis. Or as we say here in America, Children of Paradise. But for real, according to Wikipedia, the actual translation to British English is Children of the Gods, which I suppose we can talk about what that means. Anyway, seeing as how this film is about as long as two films, we're going to stick with this one topic for today, but I imagine it'll lead to broader discussions about the circumstances under which the film was made, i.e. occupied France, and how that's impacted the film's legacy. Plus, we'll talk about how it compares to other French films of the era and whether it lives up to its reputation as one of the greatest films ever made. All right, guys, shall we get this show on the road?
Yeah.
Sure.
Let's do it. All right, here we go. Marcel Carné's 1945 feature, Children of Paradise, as with most poetic realist films, serves a paradoxical function of both shaking a fist at wealth inequality and lamenting social justice issues, while also romanticizing poverty and the bohemian lifestyle. The film is populated with figures who embody the two ends of the socioeconomic spectrum. On the one end, we have a lowly mime, Baptiste, played by Jean-Louis Barrault, who spends his days being verbally assaulted by his actor father and his nights sulking backstage at a low-rent theater company and wandering the so-called Boulevard du Climat, conversing with vagrants. Also occupying the lower rungs of society are Frederick the actor, played by Pierre Bresson, I hope that's how you say it, who befriends Baptiste, and the pair end up producing a very popular show together. And there's also the murderer-slash-poet Pierre, played by Marcel Héron, that's probably how you say that, who pops up periodically to whip up trouble. On the other end of the caste system is the wealthy aristocrat Edouard de Montreuil, played by Louis Salut, who likes to play tourists and hang out in the box seats far away from the rest of the riffraff who populate the theater. And now we come to the point. All four of these men are hopelessly in love with the same woman. And this being a poetic realist film, she is naturally a courtesan. Her name is Galante, like the flower, and she's played by Marcel Carné mainstay Arletty. The film is divided into two parts. The first part involves Galante's various dalliances with all the men, in particular her romance with Baptiste. Anyway, a set of circumstances, mostly instigated by the criminal Pierre, forces Galante to take up with the aristocrat and leave poor Baptiste behind. The second half deals with the consequences of Garance's decision, including Baptiste's marrying another woman and having a family with her, Frederick's continued success as an actor, and Pierre's escalating series of wrongdoings. Marketed as the European answer to Gone with the Wind, with the runtime and melancholy ending to prove it, Children of Paradise is considered by many to be one of the greatest, not just epic films, but greatest French film productions of all time. It consistently ranks among the top three francophonic movies on the Cahiers du Cinéma Greatest Films list. The list we concern ourselves with here at FlixWise is the Sight and Sound poll, on which Children of Paradise ranks as number 73. We'll talk about how this film developed its reputation as one of the greats and discuss whether or not it is worthy of that acclaim. All right, but first I got to start with the usual prompt. Do you like Children of Paradise? So Becky, I'm going to start with you.
Okay.
How do you feel about Children of Paradise?
This film is one of my favorite films of all time. I've been lucky enough to have seen it on the big screen. The first time I ever saw it was on the big screen, which was sort of a religious experience for me. And I've seen it twice on the big screen and then multiple times on DVD and Blu-ray. And it's just an extraordinary film. I think I can't come up with enough adjectives, and I'll probably spew them all over this podcast throughout this episode, of how much I love it. I think it's a staggering cinematic achievement. I think it says a lot about a class system. I think it says a lot about the theater and the stage and about love. There are so many of the characters that I just are so moved by, and the acting is profound. The music is gorgeous and beautiful. The dialogue is poetic. I can't say enough about this film, so I'm a big champion of it.
I love it. All right, Martin, had you seen it before, first of all?
No, this was my first time seeing it in preparation for this episode, and I've been kind of putting it off, actually. I think, not so much the length exactly, but it was like, I don't know, like 3 hour long period melodrama, but I thought it was fantastic. I really, really liked it, and okay. I think, like, and the Gone with the Wind comparison I've seen a few times, but it almost, like, on that spectrum of Hollywood films, like, it feels closer to something like Ernst Lubitsch's To Be or Not to Be. Like, it's for me, I thought, like, it's a little bit more on that end. And it's, and in some ways, I thought it was like a film about melodramatic emotions, not so much that it is like a melodrama. And you can watch these characters with a little bit of distance, but it feels like it's in a tradition of films about, you know, people working in performing arts, like you know, Mike Leigh's Topsy Turvy, or Amadeus, even, or like, I thought a little bit of I know Ed Wood's not a perfect example, but like, the, you know, those sorts of films about the people who put on plays or films, and just, you know, the way that actors are, and the sort of over the top way that some of these people can be, in the over the top emotions. I really like being in that world, actually. And I really enjoyed the film. So.
Oh, yay. That's fantastic news. Wonderful. I guess I have to, like, count myself as a bit of a skeptic. But I do appreciate the sort of, I think there is a distancing effect. It is about the, how the audience relates to sort of the theater and art, and it's just unabashed championing of these characters and these pursuits is very, it's precious. But I guess to me, like, it's missing a little bit of irony, which like, it comes in spades and To Be or Not to Be. Right.
You think it's just,
yeah.
I thought there was a lot of irony in it. Like, I mean,
yeah, I thought there's some great irony in it too.
Even like, yeah, the fact that, like, the like, he's not quite the villain, but like the count who ends up killed at the end, who's kind of the bad suitor for the lead character, Garance, like, her the count, like, his big fatal flaw is he's sort of honest about what he wants and is realistic and pragmatic and not floral. Like, he's only floral in the giant pile of flowers that you know, like, it reminds me, like, you know, when people are gonna hate me, but you know, Shakespeare in Love, the Colin, yes, Firth character, when she's like, oh, like, what do you love about me, and he's this sort of wet noodle of a love suitor character, and he's like, your eyes, and like, he's just so terrible at the kind of poeticism, and, like, you know, you can tell that these characters really love the not even just the affection, but, like, I kind of get the impression that to some extent all these guys are kind of love more in like in love with the idea of being in love with Garrett's, like she becomes sort of a symbolic love to them than a person that they can really fall in love with. Like I found that was kind of an interesting quality, and it's sort of about the performances in these types of relationships. Like they're all performing even when they're not on stage.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Becky, I mean, so where do you agree with Martin? Is that kind of where the irony is coming from?
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite ironic parts is when Baptiste it's in the second part of the film, The Man in White, and he's just he has just seen Garance and like missed seeing her. Like he knows that she came to visit him and she left, and he's like super depressed about it. He doesn't know what to do, and he mentions that he spoke to a doctor, and the doctor suggests that you should go see Baptiste. That'll cheer you up, which I thought was incredibly ironic because he is Baptiste and he is this amazing performer that makes other people happy. But I also just love how all of these characters, I mean, every single one of them, down to even like the secondary characters, have so much depth to them. I feel like you really get to know them, and they're all sort of, there's a flip side to all of them. Like one in particular, which is a secondary character, is Avril, which is Lassenaire's sort of like wingman. Mm-hmm. Lassenaire's a thief and a criminal, but Avril's like, you know, at the beginning of the film, you see him in this bar and he takes a shot at Baptiste. He throws him through a window and he seems like a big thug. But then later, there are scenes when it's revealed that he just absolutely loves Frederick. He's a huge fan of him. He just loves the theater and the stage. And there's also this really funny scene where him and Lassenaire go to a bar to talk about their next like heist, a criminal act they're about to do. And Lassenaire orders a whiskey, and Avril looks over at the bartender and asks for a hot chocolate with whipped cream. It's so cute. Like there's so many of these people who are just so many different things and like what they portray themselves to be. And even the Count, who I just, you know, really detest, when he does come to Garance and, you know, tries to win her over, when she, you know, challenges him, you know, all of his, even his dialogue is very poetic. When he talks about how real women, you know, beauty, women of beauty can never be loved, but he just goes off in this whole poetic, like diatribe, and I feel like everybody is more than what they seem. And I love how Frederick and Baptiste form this amazing friendship that you really feel like it's earned in the second part of the film, when they're just when Baptiste doesn't like Frederick in the beginning, and just there's so many things that are just people reveal themselves to be more than they are.
Well, even like blind people performing that they, you know, they actually see, or, you know, little details like that, even into the minor characters.
I guess my question then is, how does the movie feel about Baptiste, right? Because I think that determines how we're meant to view the film as a whole. If his struggle to, like, if his heartache over Garance at the expense of his family is meant to be taken seriously, then I think the whole notion of love and the romanticization of these romantic pursuits is something that the movie ascribes to. If we're sort of meant to roll our eyes at it, then that's certainly kind of an ironic distancing, right? So what do you make of the Baptiste character?
Baptiste is actually my favorite character of the whole film. And, you know, film in general, I think, is also oftentimes, you know, how you perceive film is based on your own experiences. So it's possible other people could view Baptiste as somebody to roll their eyes at and that he's way too romantic. I absolutely love him. I think he's wonderful. I think his whole story arc is completely heartbreaking. And I'm actually one of those people who, and I know there's, people can perceive his wife differently, who ends up becoming his wife, but I'm not a big fan of hers. I can talk for an hour about her in general. Baptiste, I think, is just so wonderful. I think he talks about how he has a rough childhood and he's sort of a dreamer, but I think he just loves Garance. Like, he's just so floored by her. And when he presses his love to her, he wants something so much more. He wants her to return the love that he has for her in this epic sort of way. And she's just not ready for that. She's, you know, wants to take, is willing to, you know, sleep with him and let's take it slow. And like, love is simple, but he wants this epic, like, proclamation from her. And so she's not able to give it to him right then. Then he walks away and he misses out and he's always, you know, just regrets that. But I think his love for her is so grand that I think in the second film, he sort of just gives in to the full court press of Natalie later because he sort of settles for her. So I don't even blink an eye that he drops her in a second when he finds out Garance is for him, because he's always been upfront and from the very beginning. I don't think he's ever misled Natalie that he likes her. In the beginning, one of the first things she says to him is, "I love you. I love you enough for the both of us. And one day you'll love me." And he's just, you know, he's very clear that he's not interested in her, and so she just consistently gets in the way. And so I think eventually when Garance leaves, he just settles for her. And so I don't think she should know that he doesn't love her. So I actually have no problem with him leaving her for Garance at the end. But I just think I just absolutely love him. And I love his whole story arc from becoming, he's sort of this street performer in the beginning that his father doesn't appreciate him. He becomes this incredibly well-known mime in the Funambulu theater, and his character is actually based on a real person who they were going to have at the end of the movie, this sort of tragic ending for Baptiste that we could talk about later that they didn't put into the movie. So the movie would have had like more of a tragic ending than it had. But I just think his whole story arc is wonderful, and I think he's amazing, and I totally just think he's passionate and wonderful, and I really believe that Garance loves him too.
Okay, all right, Martin, how about you? How do you feel about Baptiste?
I'm a little bit less positive on him. Like, I think there are things about the character that like I don't like as much, and the sort of jealous side of him when it comes out, like, "Oh, I hate these flowers." You know, but
I love,
like,
that scene.
It's such a good scene. It almost feels like between the three sort of main men floating around Garance, like, they're all like maybe like one third of a good person for her, you know. And I don't know, like, Baptiste, maybe out of all of them, he's the one that you can kind of have the most pathos for, maybe. Like, I don't know, Lassenaire, the aspiring writer, the thief, like, he's a little bit more assertive, and like, you know, he has kind of a bolder personality. Like, Baptiste, there's something a little bit sad about him, and he's a little bit self-loathing at certain points, and he almost makes me think of not Buster Keaton exactly. I'm trying to think of, like, you know, when you watch, like, some of these like silent comedians in the sound era, like, mm-hmm. he almost makes me think of that. Like, you know, somebody who's just like a little bit out of time, or like a little bit of course, not washed up, because it actually gets more successful over the course of the film. But, you know, there's something a little bit like sad about the wrong timing of his situation that he kind of finds himself in.
Sure. I mean, there's just also something a little bit emo about him.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. He's like a little bit of...
he's an artiste. Like, that's his character.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
Even more than Frederick. Like, Frederick, he's like the kind of actor who, you know, he parties on the side, and like, he's a little bit more like down to earth, I find. Like, there's that line about I think Baptiste, Natalie says, like, "Oh, he's the sleepwalker on the roof, like, don't wake him up," basically.
Yeah. Oh, I hate it when she said that about
him. Right, but like, there's something a little bit true, I think, about that perspective of the character, that he's he's sort of got his head, I guess, in the clouds a little bit to some extent, and he's not as grounded as maybe some of the other guys in the film.
Sure. Right. Yeah. I guess But to the question about how does the film view him? Do you think that the film, I guess, sympathizes with him? Do you think it's?
I think so. Sort
of, yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, that could be my own self projecting. But I don't think I ever. That's what's so fascinating about being on this podcast and talking about films in general is that, you know, my perspective is not at all. I think that they see him as the hero of this film, and they have that Garance really loves him, and they show that passage of time, and that they did have loved each other. Like in the second part, it has been 6 years, and it's revealed that they have, you know, never missed a day without loving each other. I think it's very earned, and so I think he's treated very warmly, and also to the fact that, you know, one of my absolute favorite scenes is that scene in the second part where Garance is in the box with Frederick and they're watching Baptiste on stage. And I think even the film shows that the characters are in awe of Baptiste when they're watching him slow on stage, and Frederick turns to Garance and says, "Oh, he's so wonderful." And they're just kind of just watching him, and they allow just the viewer of the film just to bask in how amazing he is as this character. And so I think that they show the characters a love of him, the kids in the balcony, like the people who are in the cheap seats in the audience that love him. And I think it shows that he loves, in the beginning of the movie, there's a scene where Baptiste talks to Frederick about people that sit in the balcony, and he says, they understand though they are poor. And he's like, I like them. I love them. I know them. Like, he really appreciates his audience too. So I think they show him as like this fully fleshed out, wonderful character who really loves his audience. His audience loves him. The people around him love him. Even Natalie loves him. I think it's sort of this heartbreaking, poetic ending too. So I think that the audience is, I think that the film very much reveres him, but I obviously do too.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think, and reverence, I think, is the right term. The scene you pinpointed, I think, is like a great case in point. Like, that to me, it's like the clear case for how the movie wants us to feel about him. Right? They're mm-hmm. literally telling us, isn't he amazing?
I think it wants us to feel that way about him as a performer,
sure,
you know, but like there's other aspects to the character. Like you said, he's a fully fleshed out character. I don't know if you're necessarily supposed to feel that same kind of adoration the whole way through necessarily, but like, I like there's that kind of double motif of the heart. I know Garance has the heart earrings, but also when mm-hmm. Baptiste, like, I think he's first performing, he's got the little heart necklace.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you know, he's somebody who kind of tries to wear his heart on the outside, you know, like they're both characters like that. And
mm-hmm.
I think it's easy to, you know, on one hand, admire that, and on another hand, kind of criticize some of the things that come up when, you know, the one point, like, oh, you know, this love isn't enough for me, or, you know, there are little things about it that you can say, well, I don't know if that's the right way to be, or if that's something I like about this character. But mm-hmm. you know, for better or for worse, like, he kind of, you know, there's an earnestness to what he wants and how he tries to be. And
yeah, and then that begs the question, how does Garance feel about him, right? And so how does she kind of position herself in this world where her options are limited, and
it's not a love triangle. It's like a love pentagon or tetrahedron.
Exactly. yeah, she's got I guess her options are limited or not. but her financial prospects are somewhat limited if she were to stay with Baptiste anyway.
Yeah.
How do you think she feels? When I watch the film, I sort of think of Arletty's performance as not giving away very much. She's kind of, I don't know. I guess it sort of reminds me of the woman in Rules of the Game that everyone's fighting over. Like, she seems to me I end up kind of scratching my head over what the big fuss is. But maybe you guys have more sophisticated thoughts on that matter.
I think she very clearly loves Baptiste. I think that's more clearly shown in the second part than the first part. I think in the first part, she is just a self-made woman. Like, I think she's fine the way how her life is. She is, like, even when she's with Lacenaire, she's you know, is at this bar with him, and she's a friend of his, and she just accepts him for who and what he is. And you find out later when Baptiste and her go for a walk that she left that job that they show her earlier at, and that she really doesn't have a place to go to because he was going to walk her home, and she doesn't really have a place to go, but she doesn't seem too worried about it. She's just very open and thinks love is simple, and he's able to get her a job at the Funen Bleu, which she does, you know. And I think, you know, she's open to whatever experiences there are. She's really fascinated by Baptiste. She thinks that he's an incredibly sweet person. And so, you know, she just met him. So I think she just wants to maybe just try and date him. But he's just like, tell me you love me. And it's like a lot for her. And so when he leaves, Frederick swoops in and they spend the night together, and it learns and ends up that they've been together for 3 weeks, because they show that 3 weeks later they've been together. But it's obvious they don't love each other. They're just, you know, dating. And Baptiste realizes that. But I think the big part, and one of the things that I just love about Garance, I think is the part at the end of the first part where the Count comes in and is so floored by her that he sort of offers her, like, in, you know, with one word, your life can change. I can give you all these things. And she's just so strong. And she says, you know, because he offers her jewels and people will be jealous of you. And she says, you know, I would take all those things if they fell from the sky. Like, of course, everybody would want money and love and, I mean, jewels and all those things if they fell from the sky, if there was no strings attached. But why do you think that if you offer me these things, I would just drop everything? How do you not know that I don't like my life the way it is? And then the heartbreaking thing, I love when she says, how do you know that someone doesn't already love me? Like, he just assumes that, you know, that she's open for the taking and that she would leave with him. And I think that's such a beautiful thing to say. And I also just, when Baptiste is so struggling at right after that, and he says, you don't love me, and he's like so upset, and then she's like, how do you know that I don't love you? I think she's very moved by his love for her. And then, you know, Natalie, who had just won a punch in the face, comes in and just, I say so. And so I'm like, damn it. So I get so mad at Natalie because I feel like they were going to be together and they were actually going to, because you see that what I think is so fascinating about Baptiste and Garance is I think that you hear them in the first part of the movie, they say very similar things. Although they're not together, they actually think alike. Like mm-hmm. when Natalie tells Baptiste, he says, Frederick and Garance live together. Like, they love each other. And he's like, if all the people that live together loved each other, the world would shine like the sun, which is very true. Not everybody that lives together loves each other. And then Garance says something very similar to Frederick about the world and how simple it is and how love is just simple. So I think they have very similar thoughts and they're about to get together. And Natalie sort of just comes in and says no and stops it. And then right after that, Garance gets in trouble and has to leave. And so I feel like they would have been together if Natalie didn't come in. And then due to circumstances, Garance has to leave. And I think in the second part, Garance does, you see her in that box, and not a day has gone by where she hasn't loved Baptiste. Baptiste has not a day has gone by he hasn't loved her. So I really think, and she is open about how much she loves him. And I think the reason that she's able to leave him at the end is because she loves him too, because she says, you have a kid, I don't want to get in the way. And so I really think that her love for him is has grown throughout the time they've been apart.
I think that time plays such a big role in it, because like you have these declarations of love in the film that are fairly grandiose and kind of easy, especially towards the beginning, and the real love kind of, I think, has to grow, and that's part of the reason why there's this big time jump. But like I think the Frederic character, like right at the beginning when he's trying to pick up Garance, and he has this, like, you know, very fancy pickup line which sounds so loving, you know, and then like she kind of turns him down and he immediately uses it on like the next woman who walks by. You know, so like I think there's that you know, you can hear these like big declarations of love in the film, but I think it knows that it takes time to get to know somebody and it takes time mm-hmm. to sort of get there, you know, which is, again, why I think that that sort of time jump between the first and second half is important, actually.
Yeah. And yet, I think it does ascribe to the idea that love is something that you just kind of feel like there's that.
How dare they?
It's like, I know. Well, sure.
You just
like,
it's feel it.
Like that first blush of love is love, right? As opposed to the kind where you actually do have to get to know the person and make a life together and see if you get along, right? Like, Garance and Baptiste spend all of one night together, right? And yet mm-hmm. their love is something for the ages. And I think that the movie wants us to believe that, I think.
Yeah, and actually they don't spend a night together because she wants to be with Baptiste, and Baptiste says,
right,
this is not what I'm looking for. I'm not looking to have, like, I mean, he doesn't say sex, but essentially it's like, I'm not looking to sleep with you. I want, like, this great love. So then, since he doesn't, you know, do that with her, Frederick ends up coming with her, and then, so it's sort of like an unrequited love because he never actually gets to be with her until the second part when she comes back. They do get that night together, but maybe that's even more powerful that they've not even experienced, like, being together physically, and they sure. And this love transcends that, which is another thing, because Natalie says to him when she comes back, like, you just come back into his life and I'm the one that's been here and I'm the one that's been next to him for 6 years. But she hasn't been, because Garance and their heart, like her heart and Baptiste's heart, they've always thought about each other. They've always loved each other. So they've been more connected than maybe Natalie and Baptiste, who they've lived together, but she really has never had Baptiste.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I'm much more sympathetic to Natalie than it sounds like you are, but because, like, I think she is also bought into this notion that, like, she loves this person irrespective of how that person actually, like, she's bought into an idea of a person rather yeah. than how the person actually is in real life, right? So, yeah. Like, I think there is an element of kind of idealizing Garance that Baptiste does.
Yeah.
And then Garance, given the time to sort of reflect on her decisions, right, she can wax nostalgic about this great love of her youth, or of 6 years prior, when, I mean, who's to say how it would have went down if they had gotten together, right?
Yeah, I think it's interesting about Natalie, though. I'm much harder on her than I think other people are. But I, you know, it's all based on experience. I mean, I think on everyone's own experiences when they watch film. But I just think what bothers me about Natalie is several things. One is that I think that Baptiste has been very open with her before he met Garance, and after, it seems that he's not interested in her. And I think the fact that she says to him, I will love it enough for both of us and we'll be together, and it's like she's willing this to happen and won't allow him to, like, to have his own opinions about it, and she feels like she knows best. And then the fact that she stops it is annoying to me, because I just think in general that people should have more respect for themselves and should, you know, want to be with someone that doesn't have to talk themselves into being with you. You should want to be with someone that loves you as much as they love you, and not have to convince someone to be with you. So I feel like she should, you know, there's somebody out there for you, Natalie, that sure. actually will love you as much yeah. as you love yeah. them. You know, and not, don't make this guy, you know, don't try to convince this person to like you. So that bothers me. But it's also funny how, like, one of the things that annoys me too is that line that you said, Martin, about how she is says, oh, he's a sleepwalker, and
right.
that's just how he is, just leave him alone. Like, I don't like how she acts like she knows him more than everyone else, and this is who he is, and I know him better than anyone else, and this is, like, I just feel like, I don't know, I think she's projected on, like, what she believes she knows the best for him in this maternal way, and that bothers me too. So I'm not, like, again, I'm not a big fan of hers, but what I also think it's so funny about this film is that she idealizes Baptiste and Baptiste idealizes Garance. And it's just this whole, like, obsessive love thing. A lot of people in this film love different people and they don't love them back. And one of the things that I like to say, which is really funny, I don't know if you guys ever seen the show How I Met Your Mother, but there's this great saying called Dobler versus Dahmer. And it's about love. And it's like, if somebody, like how Lloyd Dobler holds up the stereo and it's like a decoration of love. And it's so like romantic if you like that person. But if you don't like that person, it's like Lloyd, it's like, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer or serial killer.
Wisconsin's own.
Yeah. Well,
like, so, that, I mean, that's a funny example because like also when you go back and watch Say Anything, like, he's kind of sticking it to her, but people sort of take it as like this big romantic gesture. Like, it, you know, these things can sort of be interpreted in different ways. And I, like, there is, you know, I think partly because it is a film about actors and performance, it's like anytime the reality starts creeping in, like, that's bad. Like, that's bad for these people. They try to reject it and try to, like, you know, I think even the film tries to sort of paint them as being a little bit bad. The people who are, have kind of a realistic attitude, or, you know, feel like they're bringing some reality to this, you know, sort of stage idea of love. But like, I forget, like, you know, this whole idea of paradise, like, you know, two people together in love, that should be paradise. But you can't have paradise when there's a love triangle. Like, there's a reason why a lot of films about like the fall of society or the fall of paradise, hypothetically, it's like centered around the love triangle, like Terrence Malick's Days of Heaven. You know, all you need to do to destroy paradise is have a love triangle, because, you know, how can things be perfect when somebody doesn't love you back? Like, you can have everything you want and need, and it's still not paradise.
Sure. I mean, Gone with the Wind.
Sure, if you want, but
wow.
We're giving a lot of love advice on this episode.
It's true.
Maybe.
Before, I feel like, do we want to talk, have we hit the main characters that we wanted to kind of psychoanalyze, or do we want to talk a little bit more about Frederick or any of the other ones?
Just Frederick in general. I mean, he's another one of, like, I think he might be my second favorite character. I love Garance too, but I just love how Frederick, I just love his whole arc, his story arc. In the very beginning of the movie, he's trying to get into the Funan Blue, and they won't let him in. And he's like, you know, one day my name's going to be in lights. And then I love how in the second film, he is this great actor in the Grand Theater, which is the theater with dialogue, and Baptiste is the star of the other theater, the Funan Blue, which is the silent theater. So I just think it's nice to see that. And also in the beginning of the movie, how he's just like, doesn't really have a lot of money. And then you see him in the second part, how he's in this carriage with two women, and he still doesn't have a lot of money because he spends more money than he makes. But he's just, you know, super famous, and he kind of gets he's always like loved Shakespeare and always wanted to play Othello. And he finally realizes he's just jealous of Garance at the end, and he's like so excited because he's like, now I know what it's like to be jealous. I can finally play Othello. So I just think he's just like a really wonderful character, and so charming. And I love how when Lacenaire goes into his stage room and he's trying to go there to rob him, and then Lacenaire sort of turns it around and gives him freely the money. They end up becoming friends and have this amazing friendship. Like the fact that Fred is able to befriend this guy who's about to, you know, rob him or murder him. It just shows how wonderful and charming he is. So I just think he's such a wonderful character as well.
Yes, I agree. I think he was probably my favorite character, in that he, to me, was the most fully realized. Like, I understood him. And that's partially because he was very chatty, so that helps, you know. Actors. But,
the whole idea of, like, taking something, you know, sort of big, dramatic, melodramatic, and using that to, like, oh, like, I'm so excited, it can feed my performance. And, like, exactly. It's such an actor thing, like, you know, acting in an overly dramatic way and then using that to feed drama, and then it's like the cycle continues. But you know, there's something a little bit funny about, like, he's so articulate and persuasive, but, like, you know, he can't persuade Garance. And like Baptiste, you know, he's all physical, you know, the mime work, but, like, you know, when she's ready for sex, he kind of shies away. Like, there's these sort of strange contrasts between how the RS performers versus how they interact with her, which I don't know. I thought that was just kind of a interesting, point.
Exactly. Yeah.
I also like how Lacenaire is sort of his arc, where in the beginning he's like writing scripts on the side and writing letters for people that beat their wife that want to like get their wife to come back to them. Like he's just like not a great person, but he is also like stealing, certain things and reselling them, but he's like kind of a small time thief at the beginning, but he has aspirations to become this great criminal and he gets what he wants. And, you know, in the second part, because he finally gets the murder and gets to achieve the notoriety that he's always wanted to be. And so he's sort of waiting at the end to be found after he's murdered this person and wants to become this, to go down as this great criminal. Like he finally achieves that, and you kind of see the small time thief become this what he's always aspired to be. Like people, it's like interesting to see people live out their dreams of what they mm-hmm. imagined and wanted at the beginning of the movie, and see them, and they're so different. One wants to be a great criminal, one wants to be a great actor, one ends up being like, you know, this great mime, and Garance just wants to, you know, travel to India and see the world. So
right. Yeah,
I like all that too.
Because, like, do you think the mustache is part of the affect? Like, he's literally twirling his mustache. Like, this is what criminals do. Yes,
that's funny.
I like that. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think let's talk a little bit about the production history, because I think that's in large part why this film is so well remembered, because the circumstances of its production are kind of remarkable, right? So it came out in 1945, but that means its production took place largely under German occupation. Yeah. So I don't know. What do you guys do you see traces of either Nazi infiltration or French resistance, or do you think it's sort of apolitical? How does that color your perspective on the film? I don't know, Martin, do you want to take that one?
Sure. I mean, first of all, like, I was impressed how lavish it is. To think like this is late into the war that you could ever. I mean, I guess that's not that exceptional. It's stuff like Kolberg, where these like big mega productions being made in Germany during its last days. But sure. I didn't watch this in ideal circumstances, but you can tell just like the production design, all the extras. I think when people talk about it as sort of holding it up as an example of film as resistance, you know, it's they kind of point more to the people involved than I think things to the film in the film itself. Like it feels pretty mm-hmm. apolitical, like I think probably even less than you might expect from a film made under occupation during wartime. Like you can find other comedies and musicals and films like that from the period, French or Czech or whatever, that do have a little, you know, anti-German messages, anti-Nazi messages. Like this to me felt pretty apolitical. Like, you know, there's some stuff I know in the audio commentary they point out, like, oh, you know, look how bad the cops are portrayed in the film, but it feels pretty I think weak on that level. Like I think it has more to do with the fact I think it was the production designer was Jewish, mm-hmm. you know, few people involved were sort of associated with resistance, but there were also people sort of associated with collaboration as well. I think the actor who plays that kind of weaselly guy, that's
Jerica?
The Jean Renoir's brother, right?
Yeah.
The other Renoir.
Because he was recast.
It was getting towards the end of the war, and I guess the actor who played Jericho thought, like, there could be repercussions, or I don't know what the full story is, but they basically had to reshoot those scenes with Pierre Renoir. But, you know, he was a real Nazi collaborator. He was basically mm-hmm. a spy, and it's sort of funny you would have been playing this spy character. Like, I think, you know, just having people play their roles probably appealed more to Carnet than the actual politics, you know. And of course, the lead actress, Arletty, you know, was sort of demonized after the war and had her head shaved for cavorting with, you know, German soldier. I don't know. It feels like that there's been something a little bit built up about the film as, you know, oh, this was their like resistance to Germany, which I don't know how much that holds up under scrutiny, but I think it's impressive that, you know, you made a film under occupation that didn't feel like total propaganda, that could be released after the war ended. And it makes sense why, you know, there was so much adoration for the film when it was released, because it's so grand and there's something a little bit escapist about it. These characters escaping into fantasy, but it's substantial enough that it's not just, you know, throwaway entertainment. Like, you know, and it sort of celebrates art and French history, you know, that you can feel a little bit patriotic about watching this. Like, I think it was probably a really, really good film for the time to kind of, you know, feel better after the war, the occupation.
I think the history behind it is, I mean, I don't think the actual, I mean, I think it's all like the production of the movie and all the stuff that the filmmakers had to go through during the movie, which says a lot about that, the time that it took, and what, when it took place. But I think the actual film itself, they were, you know, at that time, like French films were, they didn't really make, like filmmakers weren't really making propaganda films. They were made by as shorts by journalists, but really not by filmmakers. I know they were in America.
Yeah, it was more like comedies and sort of escapist stuff. Yeah,
but when they were making this movie, they thought, okay, well, let's just take this film in a different time in a different time period. So let's just go to the 18th century and not worry, and just have it be in a different place. But the whole like you know, Carnet and Cosma, like you said, Cosma and Tranier. Tranier was the production designer, did all the sets, and Cosma did the music. They were Jewish, and the two of them, Prévert, the writer, and I think even the costume designer Mayo and Carnet all like were in a house for about 6 months making this movie together. They wrote the movie all together. They had this amazing friendship, and you know, there's the Tranier and Cosma had to kind of work in secret. And when soldiers would come to the house, sometimes they would hit the hide. They couldn't, they didn't, you know, they were afraid of being caught because they were both Jewish. And then they wrote in the credits that the film was done in clandestine, but the film got released after when France was liberated, which was great. But the filmmakers actually, like, they even hid like some film reels because they kind of knew that France was, looks like France was going to be liberated, and they wanted this film to come out after they were liberated. And also the Vichy government instructed that they didn't want any movies made that were over 90 minutes long. So this movie was supposed to be in two, that's why they did the two parts, but they always wanted to show them together, and they were able to show them together because France was liberated and they no longer had those Vichy rules. But there's so many things, like the Vichy government required them to hire like Nazi sympathizers to be extras. There was also resistance fighters as extras. People didn't know that they were working together. And also there just wasn't a lot of food, like in general for anybody on that time in France. Like, food was sort of scarce, so everybody on the set was starving all the time. There was times where there'd be like a set of food and like the extras couldn't help themselves and they would like eat everything, and then there would be like crap and they would have to get more food. There's this scene in where in Lassonnière's dressing room, when I mean I'm in Frederick's dressing room, where Lassonnière comes in, where there's that chicken and he's sort of eating that big piece of chicken, he gnaws off a piece and he throws a part in his pocket. That scene was really interesting too, because the Carnet talks about how the filmmaker, I mean, how pretty much the set, they were all just staring at that chicken and waiting for that scene to be over so they could just eat it, because everybody was just so hungry. So it's just so funny, like the, I mean, not funny, but this, how different it was. And also the film started taking place in Nice. It started shooting in Nice in 1943. And then shooting got interrupted because the Americans landed in Italy, and then the Vichy government took over, and then the whole team had to go back to Paris. So eventually, and they lost their funding, and eventually Pathé came and took over production, and they ended up finishing in Paris. So it's just like they had to shoot in two different locations. They had to rebuild the sets. People were starving. They had to always deal with, like I said, Nazi sympathizers, the fact that these two major people on the film were Jewish and had to hide and work on the film. It's just so fascinating. So I think it's more just like the making of the movie and how it even came out is just so extraordinary, because of the history and the time it took, and maybe, and not really so much what's on screen, because I think they did chose the subject, what was on screen, to be, know that it wasn't propaganda because it was, you know, a totally different time period.
Sure. Yeah. And during this time, the like Goebbels and co required that any French productions submit a detailed treatment. So like the popular mode of filmmaking prior to the occupation was that you could kind of make it up as you go along, you could make changes, but that was no longer the case here. So those restrictions certainly came into play. And it's also really interesting because the mode in which this is made is like typically referred to as poetic realism, whatever that means, which we can talk about.
You know it when you see it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it was a mode popularized in the 1930s in France, which was kind of considered to be the golden age of French filmmaking. But those films were condemned by the Vichy-controlled government. So the fact that this film kind of plays on a lot of the tropes that would have been familiar to audiences in the 1930s, and that it came out after the liberation, like it does seem like it might be symbolic to, you know, French resistance, people who fought for the French resistance, kind of signifying their triumph. But anyway, onto the poetic realism point. I don't know. Do you see traces of this kind of notion of, I don't know, first of all, let us define poetic realism. Your guess is as good as mine, frankly, because I mean, I think it is purposefully nebulous, right? It's not something like, I don't know, French New Wave, which refers to just a specific time period, right? This seems to be about, like, certain subject matter, certain kind of, there are certain tenets of it, but they aren't clearly defined. So when I say poetic realism, what comes to your mind? Martin, do you want to take that?
Sure. Right. I guess, yeah, it's an expressive style based around things from real life. You know, it's meant to have some basis in reality, but it's typically more stylized than, you know, of course, later on the neorealist films you think of. You still have actors, you still have, you know, you always think of it, there's like a kind of haze around a lot of these films, Renoir's films. You know, they're very expressive, you know, in a way that's not quite the same as the German expressionist films. You know, it's toned down. It's not like Caligari, which is all psychological. Like, this is meant to be drama from real life and depicting things from real life. So, like, I think that's kind of my understanding of it. But again, like I said, it's sort of a know it when you see it deal totally. With these movies.
Yeah. And I should say, you know, popular films include La Talente.
Sure. Jean Vigo, of course. I mean, Renoir is kind of the go-to one. And this does feel like it's, you know, before I was listing off the films that were, you know, about people working in the arts, but like, there's a certain kind of like lavish realist tradition. Like, we talked about the Leopard, Visconti's The Leopard, I guess, last year or the year before. Like that feels like it probably has some common ground with these films, this one in particular.
Yeah. No, and I think Visconti sort of honed his craft, or at least learned the basics of filmmaking in this mode, right? So, yeah, I think that's a good example of kind of a later day
sad aristocrats realism.
What's that?
Sad aristocrats. No,
exactly, pretty much. Becky, do you, what are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, when I think of, I guess, poetic realism, it's more of like the working class, I guess. And there are films more about the working class or unemployed or criminals, which, you know, this film had all of those in those. Sure. But they also, one big tenet is they emphasize beauty of the ordinary people and places. And I feel like this, you know, did do that with the stage, behind the stage, all of the different characters had such beauty to them. And then the other thing is that usually it's like there's a life of disappointment and then like a last chance at love. That's another theme. And that they're sort of like nostalgic and they have a certain bitter tone to them and they're stylishly lit. But what I think is interesting is this film does bend and sort of very like poetic, you know, realism, like because of it is sort of dark, like, you know, Baptiste is surrounded by all these characters just in the Pierrot costume. There's just in the sea of them. It is just really transcendent when you see it on the big screen. And I highly recommend, if there's ever a screening out there on the big screen and you haven't seen this film, that scene in particular is just like, it's just transcendent. But what's really interesting is, you know how I mentioned before that several of these characters in the film are sort of made modeled after real people, characters in real life history. in particular, the Jean-Gaspard de Barreau, which was the character in the film, is based off of him. But he's the one that sort of created this Pierrot character. But the real Jean-Gaspard de Barreau, he was going for a walk, and like he was really famous, and he was going for a walk one day with his two kids, and a young man kind of bumped into him and started like making fun of him and said, "Look at that Pierrot, the Pierrot character from the Funan Bleu with his whore." So he called his wife a whore, and then he said that he was dummy, and he just said all these sort of names. So the real person, de Barreau, took his cane and hit that young man on the head, and he killed him, and he died in like within an hour. And he was tried for manslaughter. He was later released, but that's something that really happened, and that's actually what encouraged the real actor to want to play him. Like when Carnet was interested in making this film, Barreau, the guy that played Baptiste, said to him, "Oh, I would love to play somebody like the real de Barreau." And so what was interesting is in the script, they didn't shoot this because that would have been really fatalistic and very poetic realism, was that in the scene where he is, you know, when Jericho kind of gets to him at the end and he's kind of pulling on a shirt and he's like, "Get away from me," because he hates that character of Jericho. In the actual script, Baptiste takes Jericho's cane and hits him on the head to get away from him, and he walks away. And then later, people in the audience start screaming, and it's revealed that Jericho has died. So in the movie, like, Baptiste is supposed to be arrested and tried. So that's just really dark. And the film doesn't end that way. It's just in this really sad way. But that's I think like that would have been really much more bleak.
Sure.
Yeah. Ending.
Yeah. I mean, let's talk about how the kind of popular mode of French filmmaking involved these very kind of downbeat, melancholy endings, which I think contrasts with the typical American mode where everything has to end up happy, right? Why? I mean, I don't want us to kind of make super broad generalizations about sort of the tastes of both countries, because obviously there's a lot of diversity in both places, right? And different sensibilities throughout. But I don't know, what do you make of the at least in this era, this kind of the appeal of this kind of downbeat ending, where the hero kind of loses out in the end?
I mean, there's no shortage of French films from around this time period that do have the kind of happy, upbeat ending, but I think just audiences were okay to see the downbeat ending too. And you know, there's something that speaks to the bitter side of life, the darker side of life that I think American films could gloss over sometimes. You know, and like again, there's great American films too that have these dark, downbeat endings or ironic endings, or I don't know. I've been like on a John Huston kick lately, and sure, you know, there's plenty of those in his
yeah,
films.
Come to think of it, Maltese Falcon doesn't end all that happily, right?
A bunch of them.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm thinking
Treasure
of
Sierra Madre.
Yeah, that's a pretty dark ending. Yeah, yeah, but so like 1930s though. So Gone with the Wind doesn't have an especially happy ending. But I guess Casablanca, not. I mean,
it's bittersweet. Kind of bittersweet. I mean, like yeah. I think like a lot of great films do have that bittersweet quality to them. Like it's easy to kind of go all dark or go, you know, everyone's happy and, you know, money rains from the sky, they kiss and get love. And like, you know, like I think it's hard to kind of strike the balance where you kind of feel like, yeah, some things turn out better, some things turn out worse. You know, that's life. That those kinds of endings are a little bit tricky, but...
Right. Yeah.
I'm just thinking like how the film would have ended if you like just whacked Renoir on the head with a cane or something.
Sure, and, yeah.
That would have changed the film, but that's interesting.
I kind of like that. But I think there is something to the specific way that there seems to be a trend. Like, I'm thinking of something like, I don't know, like Pepe Le Moko, right? Where there's this glamour of like the rogue hero meeting his fate, you know? And here, once again, like, these two are destined to never be together. And there's something romantic about that too, right? In its way.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, I feel like,
are you going to be the voice of dissent?
No. No, I mean, I will just say, like, I don't have very strong feelings one way or another about this movie. But I love that you guys do. I will just say that.
You know? we're up in the nosebleeds shouting.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like I'm in the orchestra section feeling very reserved, I guess. Like, yes, very, like, I'll give a like golf clap to it, you know. All right. So I think that just about brings us to the final question. Children of Paradise is the 73rd movie on the Sight and Sound list. Is it worthy of that 73rd spot? Becky, I think I know your answer, but I'm going to give you the floor anyway.
Yeah, can I throw more adjectives at this film?
Sure. Yeah. Go for it.
No, I think this, you know, people often regard this film as one of the best French films ever made. I think it's one of the best films ever made. I just, like I said, it's a stunning cinematic achievement. It's awe-inspiring. It's jaw-dropping. I think it's magic. That's even more adjectives for you. I just think, yes, sure, it deserves to be, I think, even higher on the Sight and Sound list. We've talked so much about just the dialogue and the production history, and there's so much to this movie. There's so much history, and I think it just reveals itself. It becomes even more rewarding on multiple viewings. So maybe, Martin, maybe if you do decide to see it again,
sure,
you might even catch stuff you hadn't caught before. It's really just a wonderful achievement. One of the things that I wanted to bring up, which I thought was so fascinating, that was in the commentary track that I had listened to a few years back, was in the first part of, there's two different, if you listen to the Criterion, there's two different commentary tracks by two different like film professors. The first one has, there's the first part is a different person, the second part's a different professor. But the first part, the professor's talking about how Thomas Lebhart in Modern and Postmodern Mime, the book, suggests that the three men in this film love Garance from different parts of their body, and that Lacenaire loves her with his head, and Frederick loves her with the flesh, and Garance and Baptiste loves her with his heart. And it really has a really nice ring around it. I think that that's just a wonderful way to think about how all these characters love her in a different way, and she appeals to them a different way, and how everybody's sort of just so complex, and how love is complex. And that Garance doesn't really want to settle for any of these type of loves until she finally gives in to her heart. This film is just very profound, and I do think if it does come out on the big screen that you guys should seek it out. I mean, before, this film used to be on Laserdisc, like the 1991 Laserdisc, and on VHS copies, it was just really poor quality. And when Criterion sort of got a 35mm print and restored it in 2001, it came out on DVD, and then they put it out on Blu-ray in 2011. Now you're able to see it in its full glory without all the scratches, and that is also when they have sometimes theaters like the New Beverly in Los Angeles and the Arrow. That's two places that I've seen it in LA. Sometimes
I saw it at the New Bev.
Oh, maybe we went to
the same screen.
Maybe. I saw it in 2003 or 2004, right around the time they re-released it.
Maybe that was when
I was all alone in the theater, and maybe I could have sat next to you. Or you could have been my wingman.
God.
We could have had this religious experience together. blows our mind. But I think you know, in New York and LA or wherever, I feel this film does get re-released every few years, and I think you owe it to yourself. I mean, it's one experience to see it on Blu-ray because it is pristine, but it really is, like I said, a religious experience to see it on the in the big screen.
Hmm. Martin, how about you?
I'm too embarrassed to say how I watched this, but no, that was really interesting what you were saying like a minute ago about how each one loves them in a different way. I'm going to have to think more about that, but like, trying to distill it to a single statement, the film almost feels like love's simple. No, wait, it's really, really complicated. No, wait, it's simple. Like, that to me is kind of the trajectory of the film, but I definitely want to go back to it, and for a film that is 3 hours long, like, I think it's really light in its feet and enjoyable, and you can kind of connect it to a lot of other films, like Last Metro or whatever. Like, you know, it definitely fits into a tradition of films that I find interesting, and yeah, the top 100 makes sense to me. Like, why would be on the Sight and Sound list? It's like, sure. You know, it feels like such a staple French film, especially watching it now. Like, kind of, like, oh, you know, that's referencing this, and all these other films are referencing it. Like, you know, all of a sudden the Wes Anderson Moonrise Kingdom jokes make sense now with the animal costumes, or you know, like it just kind of feels like one of those films where, like, oh, like, you know, I slot that in, and all of a sudden these other things start to fit in around it. It starts to make sense. So, like, I was really impressed, and I really enjoyed it. So, yeah, that's my feelings on it.
Okay. I mean, I will just say that it kind of reminds me of something like Rules of the Game, where...
Oh, no.
I understand that people love it. It doesn't happen to speak to me. Sure. And that is my own shortcoming.
Well, films are all subjective. They can.
It is true. That's true.
Yeah. No, you have to love it.
You have to love it. You must. But I feel as someone who has aspirations of being a film scholar, there are certain things that you simply must love. It's there are rules, you know,
of the game.
So it's not that I dislike it. I just I don't get those same rapturous feelings that you do, but that makes sense. Like, it's worth watching.
Like, you know, any film that's sort of about love and about characters who are very actory, you know, like, I think it's easy to kind of come away with different reactions. Like, you know, even just, you know, between your comments and Becky's comments, like, I feel like some stuff I'm kind of in the middle on, like, not in terms of like how much I like it, but just like how I feel about certain characters, or you know, like, it's a film that I think you could feel differently about. I totally think that's fair.
Sure. All right. Yay! Validation. All right. Okay. Well, you know, listeners can write to us and let us know what they think. And that's the way we frame it, FlixWise. That is... Listeners, what do you make of Children of Paradise? Timeless masterpiece, or product of its era, or something else? Come let us know on our website, flixwise.com. Or you can leave us a note on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flixwise. And if you'd like to give me a hard time about my terrible French pronunciations, you can come find me, or us, on Twitter. The handle is @flixwise. On our next show, we have more action from Paradise, only this time trouble awaits. I'm very pleased to announce that Joe McBride, who recently published a book on Ernst Lubitsch, is going to join me for a discussion on Lubitsch's 1932 masterpiece, Trouble in Paradise. So stay tuned for that. Until then, Becky, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's your first, but
I did a lot of gushing.
Yes, as you should. I am here for your enthusiasm. but can you tell listeners where they can find you on the internet?
Oh, absolutely. They can find me at Hollywood Minotaur. That's on Twitter, and that's H-Wood Minotaur. And I am a big, huge Bergman fan, and also really love Star Trek, and just like all sorts of just eclectic taste in film. So you can reach out to me and talk about anything you want, sci-fi. Wonderful. And, you know, obscure French films, or, you know, Bergman. I'm here for you.
Yeah. And I think, Martin, I don't think do you know this? I just wrote Becky into doing Seven Seal, so.
Oh, great. Yeah. That's perfect news.
That'll something more to look forward to. And then Becky, we'll talk Star Trek because I also happen to really like Star Trek.
Oh yay!
Yeah, do a Star Trek episode.
Oh, would that be fun?
Oh, that'd be great.
City on the Edge of Forever. Forever.
Forever. All right, Martin. I'll see you another 6 months.
Sounds good.
God,
want to see my mime impression?
Yeah. You're funny. You're funny. Got jokes. Martin, what's your Twitter handle?
It's at Movie Kessler.
At Movie Kessler. All right. Listeners, if you don't already, you should probably follow Martin.
If you want. You don't have to.
All right. Wonderful. Until we meet again, vive la France.
Vive la France.
Vive la France!